Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the dystopian world of George Orwell's novel 1984, in which war is peace, love is hate, and lies are truth, a world the United States has now entered as our big brother, Donald Trump, moves from creating alternative facts to rewriting history. Historian Alan Lichtman, who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency, joins us. Against all odds, Alan predicted a Trump victory in 2016, and his latest national bestseller is The Case for Impeachment, and we will discuss Trump's call yesterday to the veterans of foreign wars, quote, "Just remember, what you are seeing and what you are reading is not what's happening." But even more Orwellian is that The Atlantic discovered that the White House had altered and censored the official transcript of the recent press conference in Helsinki, erasing the question by Jeff Mason of Reuters, who asked President Putin, "Did you want President Trump to win the election, and did you direct any of your officials to help him do that?" To which the Russian leader responded, yes, I did, because he talked about bringing the U.S.-Russia relationship back to normal. And although millions around the world saw the exchange, it has now been purged from the official record by Donald Trump, who, after telling his supporters to only believe him and not the press, claimed that Russia was going to meddle in the November elections to help the Democrats. Then, with elections in Pakistan marred by deadly suicide bombings, we'll get an analysis of today's election, in which the Pakistani people had to choose between a former playboy and cricket star, Imran Khan, and the brother of the former disgraced Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif. Suja Nawaz, the former director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council and author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to discuss how already the incumbent party has rejected the results, claiming vote rigging by the military, who are rumored to be behind the likely winner, Imran Khan. Then finally, we'll examine the White House meeting today between President Trump and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, in which the leaders agreed to hold off further tariffs and reassess existing tariffs while working together towards zero tariffs. Timothy Canova, a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University College of Law, who teaches regulations of international financial institutions and international trade and development law, joins us to discuss how Trump is robbing Peter to pay Paul by pressuring the Europeans to buy U.S. soybeans, which China is now boycotting because of U.S. tariffs Trump slapped on them, while at the same time Trump bribes the U.S. farmers impacted by China's retaliation with a $12 billion handout. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way of predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election went against all odds. He predicted a Trump victory. His latest book is a national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, now out in an updated version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And Alan, what did you make of President Trump's speech yesterday in Kansas City before the Veterans of Foreign Wars annual convention, where he said, invoked, in fact, the audience, "Stick with us. Don't believe the crap you see from these people," he pointing at the news cameras in the back, "the fake news. What you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening." And you have to add to that that the White House is already editing and censoring transcripts of President Trump's press conference with Vladimir Putin, the recent press conference in Helsinki. And he's also now making absurd claims that Putin and the Russians will now interfere in our elections to help the Democrats. So it feels like we're not moving into George Orwell's world. We're already in it.
Absolutely. I warned of that when I first published the first edition of my book now a year and a quarter ago. And I talked about the fact that Donald Trump is not merely a liar. It goes beyond that. He has dissolved the very notion of truth, even the very notion of reality, itself. And he has plunged us into the George Orwell world, where truth is meaningless and everything is controlled and manipulated by the Trump figure there, of course, Big Brother. Big Brother tells you that famine is plenty, then surely it is. If Big Brother tells you that war is peace, surely it is. If Big Brother tells you that hate is love, surely it is. This is truly frightening. It goes beyond any policy differences you may have with President Trump. It goes to the very integrity, not just of our democracy, but really of the entire project of hundreds of years devoted to finding the truth, to relying on evidence, to objectively analyze information. Instead, now, we are in the Orwellian world, where, by the way, one word that was entirely banned in 1984 was the word science.
Well, the Atlantic was first to report this discrepancy, that the White House official transcript of the press conference with Vladimir Putin and President Trump following their two-hour secret meeting, there's an important moment when the Reuters reporter Jeff Mason asked Putin the question, did you want President Trump to win the election and did you direct any of your officials to help him do so? And Putin immediately answered and said, yes, I did, because I wanted Donald Trump to be elected because he would normalize U.S.-Russian relations. And, of course, the second part of the question Putin did not answer. That's all been cut out of the official White House transcript. And, by the way, the White House have also altered the video of the news conference at their website. So, as a historian, have you ever heard of the official record in America being censored?
Even Richard Nixon didn't go that far. We are in absolutely uncharted territory. And again, this is very Orwellian, because one of the fundamental precepts of 1984, and I can really appreciate this as an historian, he who controls the past controls the future. So if you can actually edit and distort history for your own purposes, in fact, that gives you a powerful tool for controlling not just the past, but for the future as well. I also think this may be a federal crime. After all, there are laws on the preservation of official records, and certainly a presidential news conference with a foreign head of state would be an official record. And it seems to me, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, I've studied these matters, that deliberately distorting and altering an official record would be a violation of the Federal Records Act. You know, every time Trump does something dastardly, you know, this fellow Alan Dershowitz, you know, who's made a name for himself as Trump's chief defender, comes out and says, oh, there's no crime involved here. You know, truly, Trump could shoot someone on Pennsylvania Avenue. Not only would his supporters still support him, but Alan Dershowitz would come out and say, oh, there's no crime here. I think there may well be a crime here, as well as a crime against history, a crime against the American people. And really, Trump is committing a crime that, as I said, violates the thrust of hundreds of years of history to get away from superstition, to get away from truth as defined by authoritarians, and search for an impartial, objective truth. If we lose truth, there's very little left.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, to think that Trump thinks he can get away with it, and maybe he is, at least with his base, because the whole world saw that press conference between Trump and Putin. It was a major event. I mean, that's the part of it that's extraordinary. You almost like you need a new word for chutzpah.
Yeah, I talked about this in the case for impeachment as well. Another feature of Donald Trump, and by the way, this is nothing new to Donald Trump, the president. In the case for impeachment, I trace his entire, you know, 45-year career as a businessman, and he routinely did the same thing. This is not something that he's changed and done. This is quite deliberate. And by the way, I absolutely wince every time a pundit says, oh, he doesn't understand, he's not knowledgeable, nonsense. Trump knows exactly what he's doing. He's been doing it for almost 50 years. It has nothing to do with his being naive or not understanding. This has always been the Trump MO, to warp history, to lie, to flout the law in order to benefit no one but himself. And the second technique he has used is a classic technique of the dictators. It's called the big lie. If you say something often enough and vehemently enough, then people will come to believe it. You know, a 40-plus percent of Republicans came to believe that Trump won the popular vote, even though he lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million people. Lots of people believe that somehow 3 to 5 million illegal voters mysteriously appeared on Election Day, all voted for Hillary Clinton, and somehow disappeared. These are such blatant lies, you couldn't imagine anyone being taken in by them. But the big lie, in fact, does work. By the way, I've always wondered, you know, if Hillary Clinton mustered these 3 to 5 million illegals to vote for her, why do they all vote in New York and California, where their votes made no difference? Why aren't they in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio? Just a thought.
Well, Alan Lichtman, again, is an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. His latest book, a national bestseller, is The Case for Impeachment, now out in an updated edition. So the New York Times reporters at the White House, Katie Rogers and Maggie Haberman, wrote in a piece on Wednesday, Mr. Trump is at a pivotal moment in his presidency. He's increasingly living in a world of selected information and bending the truth to his own narrative as his aides work to keep him insulated from the outside world. Mr. Trump is doubling down in his efforts to tell supporters to trust him over the words of critics and news reports. So how much is this, again, I'm asking an historian, Alan, and you've got to go back a long way to King Canute sitting on his throne defying the tide not to come in. This is a bit like what it feels like, isn't it?
It really does. And everybody talks about the Trump base and is appealing to the Trump base. But what everyone misses, he can't win with the Trump base. That is, Republicans can't. Except, obviously, in, you know, deep red districts. But they can't control the House and the Senate or win the next presidency just based on this so-called Trump base. And everybody talks about, oh, he's got 80 to 90% approval among Republicans. But what they miss is that 80 to 90% is applied to a much smaller base. From the time of Trump's victory to today, the Republican base has shrunk by about 5 percentage points. So even if you won 90% of Republicans, even in some of these red districts, you're not going to win elections. And he is losing a critical component that Republicans need to win to hold the House and the Senate. And people have talked about this. It's not unique to me. Well-educated suburban voters, particularly suburban women, there are enough suburban districts in California, New York, Pennsylvania, other places, now held by Republicans, that if those suburban districts swing Democratic, they are going to retake the House, something that even I thought was pretty impossible a year ago. There's even a glimmer of a chance that the Democrats could take the Senate, something I thought was absolutely impossible a year ago. But right now, Democrats are competitive or ahead in Republican-held seats in Tennessee, in Arizona, in Nevada, and Democrats are holding their own in some of the deep red Trump states like West Virginia. Still a very narrow path, but it's at least now possible. And it was considered impossible, maybe even as recently as 6 months ago. So you got to understand that Republicans can't control government based on the Trump base alone, and the kinds of people that he's alienating could be truly deadly to Republican hopes in November.
But in the last midterm elections, only one-third of registered Democrats voted, and that prompted Barack Obama to say that the Democrats almost have a genetic problem in voting in midterms. Do you have any indications that this is going to change? Because if they don't get a big turnout, everything you're saying is not going to happen.
That's correct. You're absolutely right. In midterms, turnout is everything. One of the shocking and sad facts about American political life is that if you look at the eligible adult population in this country, less than 40%, this is astonishing, failed to turn out. Well over 100 million lost votes in midterm elections. But two things I think should give Democrats some glimmer of hope, and then I'll add a recommendation. One, of course, is the party holding the White House tends to do very poorly in midterm elections, which is the one chance people have to express discontent. In fact, the last time the Democrats did well in midterms was 2006, when the Republican George W. Bush held the White House. Secondly, if you ought to believe the polls, and I'm a bit of a poll skeptic, but presuming there is some accuracy there, they show far greater enthusiasm on the part of pro-Democratic than pro-Republican voters. In other words, people are more likely to come out because they are disgusted with Donald Trump than they are to come out because they are so supportive of Donald Trump. And the recommendation to Democrats is you can't just rely on anti-Trumpism alone, as powerful as that is. I think where the Democrats have been deficient is articulating their own positive vision for the country. I think that's hard to do, but I don't think they've been especially effective to do that. So that's my advice for the Democrats.
Well, back to George Orwell and the fact that we are living in the age of Orwell, with Donald Trump now censoring the official record of the meeting that took place recently in Helsinki with Putin and calling out to veterans of foreign wars, the military, who are normally above politics, urging them not to believe anything from the so-called fake news and only to believe him. The problem we have, surely, is that it's not just that we have this anomaly in the White House, this wannabe autocrat who's following Putin's playbook, not just in terms of geopolitics and Russian policy to weaken NATO, et cetera, he's also following the playbook of Putin's political technologist, Surkov, who came up with this idea of fake news and distracting the public. And essentially, without Fox News, you wouldn't have this phenomenon, would you, with Trump? I mean, that's the essential echo chamber that amplifies Trump's statements, is it not?
Absolutely. I understand. I don't know this, but I've read it that, you know, as soon as you get on Air Force One, the first requirement is turn on Fox News. And not only does Fox News seem to be an echo chamber for Trump, but Trump seems to take a lot of his leads from Fox News, of course, regardless of whether it's truthful or not. And, you know, in terms of this attack on the press, I would remind you of what Thomas Jefferson, who's a great conservative hero, said. You know, given a choice between a free government and a free press, I would take a free press, because without a free press, you can't have a free government. No dictatorial government has a free press. There's, you know, Putin doesn't allow freedom of expression, freedom of the press in Russia. Kim Jong-un does not allow that in North Korea. It's a hallmark of dictatorship. But again, I want to stress that the danger here is really to the whole thrust of progress since the Enlightenment several hundred years ago, where progress and freedom and prosperity has been built upon a belief in an impartial truth that people can agree upon regardless of their political positions, their religion, their ideology, their class. If there is a truth out there that we can understand and pursue, yes, we can argue and debate it, but there is still a belief in a truth. Trump in his Orwellian approach has really destroyed that. And truth for Trump, just like it is for Big Brother, becomes whatever suits his purpose at the moment. And, you know, this is particularly distressing to me as a professor. I've taught students for 45 years, and I've always taught students, regardless of your ideology, I don't care about your ideology, I don't care about your politics. One thing I've always taught my students is fidelity to the evidence, fidelity to impartial means of analysis, and trying to come as close to the truth as we possibly can do. To see that totally shattered by this president and his enablers, and I don't excuse his enablers, is particularly disheartening.
Well, just in closing, Alan Lichtman, in fact, the president had a tantrum, apparently. He came aboard Air Force One and found that the television in Melania's bedroom aboard Air Force One had CNN on. And apparently he just really screamed at his aides for that infraction. But given that Fox News is, for all intents and purposes, Orwell's Ministry of Truth, what do you think is going on with Rupert Murdoch? Because apparently, and of course Bill Shine, his deputy, who was fired from Fox because he was enabling endemic sexual harassment, he is now the new White House communications director. And you can see that they've really, since Shine's come aboard, they've even streamlined the White House Fox loop echo chamber, and it's far more efficient and more pervasive than it ever was. But a lot of reporting indicates that when Rupert Murdoch gets off the phone with Donald Trump, who apparently he talks to regularly, he turns to whoever's in the room and says, "What an effing idiot that guy is." So what explains that? Here you have the number one enabler of Trump, who privately thinks the guy is a complete buffoon.
You know, one of the universal solvents is, of course, money. And I think, you know, I can't look into the mind of Rupert Murdoch. I don't know him. I haven't studied him as a figure. But this is Fox News' coin of the realm. This is how they gain and hold on to their audience. You know, if they became kind of centrist like CNN, you know, they probably would lose a good bit of their audience. You know, while Trump's base might not be big enough to win general elections in swing districts, it's certainly big enough to make a lot of money for Fox News. That's their niche in the world of broadcasting. And by the way, you know, Trump can blast fake news all he wants, but he's probably been the greatest boon we've ever seen to cable television news. All the networks, all the outlets, rather, at least until very recently, have seen a big boost in their ratings, including, you know, the more liberal-leaning MSNBC. It just strikes me as extraordinary, you know, that this administration vilifies CNN as a big left-wing outlet. CNN is about as centrist as you can get. But in the world of Trump, if you're not a Trump sycophant, you're fake news, you're a tool of the Democrats. You know, 13 angry Democrats running the Mueller investigation. Mueller is a lifelong Republican. His boss, Robert Rosenstein, is a lifelong Republican. Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, is a lifelong Republican. It's, you know, but he makes things up and he perpetrates them as the big lie.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Anytime, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election, which, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. His latest book, a national bestseller, is The Case for Impeachment, now out in an updated version. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the elections in Pakistan that are marred by bombings and accusations of vote rigging by the military, who are rumored to be behind the likely winner, Imran Khan.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours.
Remember me,
they all my movie love.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. And he's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and was the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. He's completing a book on U.S.-Pakistan relations and the crises inside Pakistan from 2008 to the present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian.
And it's election day today in Pakistan, and it has not been without violence. There's been actually a string of bombings throughout this election season, and today there was a deadly one in Quetta. I take it that would likely be, that's Taliban territory, is it not?
Yes, it is. And also there are elements of the Islamic State that are operating.
And what would the purpose be of just to spread terror and discord, and what's their motive?
Well, exactly that, as well as the fact that the elections have brought out a large number of people, and they're soft targets, and this helps them create terror among the general population.
So the two parties vying for both for the National Assembly and for the presidency are the incumbent Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz's party and the PTI party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, which is, of course, led by the former cricket superstar Imran Khan. So the expectation from what I've been reading is that Imran Khan will win. Is that your belief?
The early numbers indicate that his party is leading in the National Assembly polls, but they, you know, all the votes are not in, and there was a three-hour delay in the transmission of results from the constituencies to the Election Commission of Pakistan and then from them to the media. So that has created a little bit of kerfuffle, particularly on the part of the parties that are not in the lead. That includes the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz group of the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and the Pakistan People's Party of former President Asif Ali Zardari, as well as the Islamic Party led by Maulana Fazlur Rahman. So a number of parties have already kind of thrown down their gauntlet to say that that there was some kind of rigging or potential rigging taking place in the election polling stations. This is was to be expected. I think almost all the parties were prepared to protest if they didn't do too well. And Imran Khan himself had shown the way in the last election by coming out to the capital and using street protests to try and topple the government, though unsuccessfully at that time.
But isn't it widely believed that Imran Khan is a sort of stalking horse for the Pakistan military and the intelligence service, the ISI?
There have been a lot of reports, but very few specifics about exactly who did what and when, about the ISI supporting individual candidates or persuading them to leave the party of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and to run as independents under the military-style symbol of a jeep. And that this group would then be used as a bargaining chip in the formation of a coalition government in parliament. Imran Khan, if he continues on the current trend, will not need any bargaining chips, because if he makes 137 seats in the National Assembly, he can become prime minister without necessarily giving anything away to any other group, including these independents. So by tomorrow Pakistan time, around midday, probably things will have become clearer, because the final results should be in. And although there will be disputes, it's quite possible that if, as scheduled, he is going to speak to the nation at about 2 p.m. Pakistan time tomorrow that he will actually claim victory.
But how much will his victory be clouded by the constant reports of vote rigging, irregularities at poll stations, and the fact that Nawaz, the Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz's party, which of course is led by his brother, I think he's in jail, is he not? They have already have a social media site that's gone viral, massive rigging. So
yes.
Is there an expectation that he'll be not entirely legitimate if he wins, which it appears to be the case?
I think it'll be a disputed win, but it will really depend on the clarity and consistency of the Election Commission of Pakistan's presentation of the results and their answering of questions about the delays in conveying the results from the polling stations to the center. So a lot will depend on that. Another issue that is underlying all of this is the battle in the Punjab, which is the largest province and has the most number of seats. But also at the provincial assembly level, whoever controls the Punjab is going to have the upper hand. And so if Imran Khan's party manages not only to win enough seats to form a government in the center, but also manages to upend the Muslim League Nawaz group's hold on the Punjab, that will be a major win for him and would allow him to proceed with, you know, economic reforms and other activities, which I'm sure that he has been working on with his team for many years now. On the other hand, if he fails to win the Punjab at the provincial level, then it will become difficult to govern the country as a whole if his only provincial base is the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, the formerly Northwest Frontier Province. So these are all the possible scenarios that will affect his ability to proceed as the Prime Minister.
And again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and he was the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States, and he's completing a book on U.S.-Pakistan relations and the crises inside of Pakistan from 2008 to the present. So the fact that the Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz Sharif's party, has its roots in the Punjab, and that's where its strength it lies. And the challenger, who looks like he might pull it off, his party, as we were mentioning earlier, Imran Khan's party is considered to be, well, somehow influenced by the military. A lot of people are celebrating the fact that this is the first time in, I think, or the second time in the history of Pakistan that a civilian government has handed over power to another civilian government, but that is somewhat clouded by suspicions about Imran Khan's ties to the Pakistan military. Isn't Punjab where most of the military recruits come from? So that seems a little odd. You've got Nawaz Sharif's political power and influence in Punjab, but at the same time, if the military are backing the other guy, and that's where most of their recruits come from, how do you explain that?
It's not easy to explain, but the military itself is not monolithic. Neither should one assume that the military and Imran Khan will see eye to eye on everything, because he does have strong views on a number of topics on which he may not agree with the military. So we have to wait to see, number one, if he becomes the prime minister, and number two, how he manages that relationship. For instance, he has been dogged by his earlier statements when he was in the opposition against the military and against the generals. He has been dogged by the moniker of Taliban Khan because of his soft spot for the Taliban in Pakistan and his desire to engage with them and to mainstream them somehow. So all of that will come into play, I suspect, over time. But the biggest challenge for him or for whoever is going to be the next prime minister of Pakistan is going to be economic. And that is something that I'm sure he's been thinking about and his team has been thinking about, because they're going to be facing a financing gap of about $25 billion for imports as well as debt servicing this year. And the only place where they can get that kind of money is the International Monetary Fund, which means that they're going to have to come up with a credible economic plan and take some prior actions in order to be able to go to the IMF and say, look, we've done all these things, now we need your help to do more and do some structural changes so that we don't get into this kind of a hole in the near future. And that's going to be an enormous task that he and his team are going to have to face, because he's brought the youth on board, for sure. And if he wins, it'll be largely because of the fact that the urban youth have come onto his side. And if they don't have jobs, and if the economy starts shrinking, then he's going to be in difficulty.
Well, I imagine that the youth have been attracted to Imran Khan's message of the fight against corruption. But it's very odd that this former cricket star and former playboy, who I think his first wife was an English heiress who was part Jewish, maybe this is a bit like Donald Trump, you know, a populist who runs against Washington, drained the swamp, and is also obviously a part of the swamp, and is very much a libertine with all kinds of playboy playmates and porn stars in the closet, and yet Donald Trump is incredibly popular with the religious conservatives in this country. So is there a similarity there? Because I don't understand why the religious conservatives in Pakistan like Imran Khan so much, given his reputation as a playboy. I think he's, what, on his third marriage now?
Well, these paradoxes have haunted him. He has publicly acknowledged the fact that he has, over the last decade or more, been converted to a very strong belief in Sufi Islam. And interestingly, that is not something that the Taliban favor. They favor a very different, purer form of Islam, and they've been attacking Sufi shrines and Sufi rituals. So he's going to have to square that circle somehow. That is an issue that he's going to have to face. Of course, allegations about his personal life and activities, particularly with the publication this month of a book by his former wife with lurid details, which have not all been answered, are obviously designed to bring out those contradictions. But those are going to be the least of his problems. I think Pakistan is a country of 200 million people. It is a country with, you know, four major provinces, with different language and ethnic and sectarian groups in them, and it needs to be brought together before the centrifugal forces split it apart, and it's going to be an enormous challenge for him or whoever's in the Prime Minister's chair to be able to craft policies that bring the country together and offer people some hope. That has been his slogan, that he wants to create a new Pakistan. So this is a bit similar to what President Obama had offered of, you know, hope and change. And he's going to have to make that a reality. Otherwise, the next 5 years are going to be tough.
But hasn't his campaign focused on corruption mostly?
It has used that as a leverage against the current group, and he has applied it against both the Pakistan People's Party and Mr. Zardari, as well as the Muslim League and Mr. Sharif.
Well, Pakistan's history largely is you either have a military government or a corrupt civilian government. I mean, corruption has been almost an historic fact, has it not?
It has been institutionalized in the government, as well as in the military, in the sense that, you know, a culture of entitlement has been created, so that you have perks and privileges because of who you are, because of the rank and so on. The question is, how do you roll that back? And Imran Khan points out to the fact that when he was running the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, that he actually managed to fire 20 of his members of the provincial assembly from his party because of corruption. So he will have the ability to set a new tone in how government is run. But there are enough doubters in Pakistan who have seen the formation of his new party, which is bringing in people from other parties who were so-called electables, who have carried all this baggage over to his party now. And one of his big challenges will be on how he can meld his old party loyalists and these new folks who have no loyalty to the party as such, but, you know, have basically signed on to him because they could mutually work with each other and benefit each other and get elected in the process.
So just in closing, Shijin Nawaz, the new Pakistan that Imran Khan talks about, will China be its major partner, if not patron?
China will play an enormous role, but I think the most important role will be that of Pakistan itself, because whatever China is doing, unless Pakistan prepares the ground for it and takes ownership for it and comes up with not just counterpart funding, but also the institutional framework to implement those $46 billion of projects, it's not going to work out in Pakistan's favor. Pakistan may end up with an enormous amount of Chinese debt and become beholden to China as almost as a virtual colony. So that's going to be an enormous challenge for whichever government is sitting in Islamabad.
Well, Shijin Nawaz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Shijin. And again, I'll be speaking with Shijin Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer and a political and strategic analyst, and has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and was the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. And he's completing a book on U.S.-Pakistan relations and the crises inside Pakistan from 2008 to the present. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the White House meeting today between President Trump and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, where the leaders agreed to hold off on further tariffs.
Makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound that makes the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Timothy Canova, who's a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University College of Law, who teaches corporations, regulation of international finance institutions, international trade and development law, and the history of economic thought. He was an early critic of financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. And in 2011, Timothy Canova was appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to serve on an advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform. And recently he ran against Debbie Wasserman Schultz for a congressional seat in Florida in an election that is still disputed. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Canova.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Tim. And President Trump and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker met today at the White House. They basically suggested somehow that they've avoided a trade war, and they've both leaders agreed to hold off on further tariffs and reassess existing tariffs on steel and aluminum and work together towards zero tariffs. So I'm beginning to get the impression that Donald Trump is sort of both the arsonist and the fire brigade. You know, he creates these terrible problems, and then, you know, he doesn't really solve them. He just has photo ops. And then, of course, in the case of the poor farmers who are getting stiff because Trump slapped tariffs on the Chinese and they retaliated by stopping buying U.S. soybeans, now Trump is giving them a $12 billion handout. So do you think anybody in this country recognizes the unbelievable amateurism of this guy lurching from one thing to another without knowing what he's doing, just basically trying to run this country like a reality TV show?
It is a roller coaster. And, you know, if there's some method to the madness, I think it's that Trump is playing to his base in starting these trade wars, in pushing for trade wars. And then he seems to pull back from it probably when the special interests start weighing in, whether it's farmers or other U.S. exporters. And then he seems to back off from the flamethrowing. So I think it is one way of appealing to his base. You've got to realize, I think we all have to realize, that while the unemployment figures are quite low, they're not tethered to reality anymore. There's an awful lot of pain in this country, probably below the top 10% of households. And trade is certainly one of the possible reasons. There's been a lot of dislocations in the workforce. And whether trade is really to blame or it's other factors, you know, politically speaking, trade certainly gets its share of the blame.
So it looks as though none of this, of course, is going to happen soon or perhaps ever. One of the things that Trump did do today was to get the Europeans to agree to buy more American soybeans.
as well as liquefied natural gas.
Right, the LNG terminals, and that takes a long time to put in those terminals, and that, of course, is going to hurt Russia, which is plays against the narrative that Trump is in Putin's pocket.
That's true. And, you know, I must say that as a candidate for Congress and ever since, I've been critical of the liquefied natural gas facilities that are being constructed in the state of Florida. There's a 515-mile pipeline, the Sable Trail Pipeline, that when it's pumping at capacity, it'll be pumping 1 billion cubic feet of highly pressurized liquefied natural gas each and every day through some very ecologically fragile areas, sinkhole country, the Florida, the upper Floridian aquifer. Environmentalists are very alarmed at these projects that are intended, apparently, to export liquefied natural gas. And now, with the deal that Trump seems to be reaching with the EU, it's going to greenlight the export of liquefied natural gas. I should also mention that I've come under attack in McClatchy and some other news outlets for my activism against the Sable Trail Pipeline and against fracking and liquefied natural gas, all because some alleged Russian bot has retweeted our messaging against fracking and the Sable Trail Pipeline, that somehow we're useful tools of the Kremlin now. And, you know, this is really unfortunate. Trump gets a lot of our attention, you could say, on the old economy, the fossil fuel economy. I think we're moving in the wrong direction on so many fronts right now.
Well, the extraction industries in general, they're the ones that are backing him. And, of course, he's got out of the Paris Accords, et cetera. By the way, Timothy, today these Freedom Caucus leaders, Representatives Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, introduced a resolution to impeach Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Not exactly a surprise. It's pretty naked what's going on here. They've made unreasonable demands that Rosenstein hand over material from the Mueller inquiry that he simply can't hand over. It would put people's lives at risk, and immediately all this material would end up on Fox News. So this is clearly a setup in coordination with Trump to try and find an excuse to get rid of Rod Rosenstein and shut down the Mueller inquiry. So I guess my question would be, why the hell would you want to join the Congress with these kind of clowns in the Congress?
Well, that's a good question. I'll tell you, you can imagine our agenda in this campaign has been much like Bernie Sanders' agenda in 2016 and mine in 2016, that we don't take any corporate money. We've been raising our campaign funds through small donations online at timkanova.com. And our agenda is very much a progressive agenda for full employment and Medicare for all, ending the drug war. It's a very good agenda. But you bring up an interesting point. I must say I've asked myself many times what it would be like to join this circus up on Capitol Hill. And, you know, it's really both parties, I must say. I hear from freshman congressmen when they arrive that they're told by the Democratic leadership that if they want to be on a certain subcommittee, they're going to have to raise maybe up to $200,000 for the Democratic Party. And the response is usually, well, how can I raise that kind of money? And the party leadership says, don't worry, you'll go to the call center. You'll go to our call center. You will make phone calls, and we'll give you a list of CEOs to call. If you want to get on an energy subcommittee, the CEOs will be the CEOs of the top energy companies in the world. If you want to be on, let's say, a healthcare subcommittee, you're going to be calling the CEOs of big pharma and private health insurers. So, you know, both these parties have come to be so dominated by corporations. It's very easy with the infighting, certainly over Donald Trump and Russia and all of that, to forget how much these two parties really have in common. And I've been seeing it firsthand here in Florida. You alluded to how our last election is still somewhat contested. We had our doubts about the final results in our August 2016 primary against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and we put in a public records request. The supervisor of elections really stonewalled us for more than half a year, and it forced us to file a lawsuit. While the lawsuit was pending, the supervisor destroyed all of our ballots in violation of federal law and state law. We're talking about criminal felony statutes. She admitted to it in videotaped depositions, and the Florida Circuit Court ruled for us, granted a summary judgment, and laid out exactly all of these laws that the supervisor violated. You would think the Republican governor would be incentivized to act. After all, this is a Democratic scandal, a Democratic supervisor of elections in a highly contested Democratic primary. And the Florida governor has done nothing. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement, also in Republican hands, nothing. And the Justice Department, the U.S. Attorney, so far nothing. And what I'm hearing from Republicans is that while the rank and file of Republicans are outraged about this ballot destruction, the leadership answers to the same big corporate interests that backed Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Democrats, and they have no incentive to change the status quo. They're willing to sweep this scandal under the rug as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Timothy Canova, who's a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University College of Law, who teaches regulation of international finance institutions, international trade and development law, and the history of economic thought. He was an early critic of financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. And in 2011, Timothy Canova was appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to serve on an advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform. And he recently ran against Debbie Wasserman Schultz for a congressional seat in Florida in an election that is still disputed. So back to the meeting today at the White House between Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Commissioner, and the head of the European Commission, and President Trump. Juncker did say that the cycle of tariffs, and after all, it was Trump who imposed tariffs on Europe on steel and aluminum. He referred to it as basically a stupid process, and that the Europeans have been forced to respond in kind. And he went on to say, we will now impose tariffs on motorcycles, Harley-Davidson, on blue jeans, Levi's, and on bourbon. We can also do stupid, he added. So I wonder that, whether that was a kind of barbed reference to the chap with the orange hair that happens to occupy the Oval Office at the moment.
Well, if your guess is as good as mine, and it probably is a reference to Trump. I do think Trump was heavy-handed on these tariffs and misguided. The problem, I think, is that this Washington Wall Street consensus, which includes trade liberalization, has really been failing miserably politically and economically in many ways. Trade has expanded. The benefits of trade, however, seem to flow only to the very top, the elites, the CEOs, and big shareholders. And it has the opposite effect on most workers, leaving them dislocated, out of work, stagnant incomes. Is it good for consumers? Of course, it's lower prices. But the problem is all of us consumers also wear another hat as workers, as people who have to earn a living so that we can consume. And this free trade regime that includes central bank independence, fiscal austerity and privatization, liberalization not just of trade but also of financial flows, I think it's been a disaster. It's led to very high levels of underemployment. Most of it is well hidden and not widely reported by government statistics, but it's certainly out there. And it has an interesting effect in both the United States and throughout the European Union. When you have this kind of pain among the working class and poor folks, quite often they take it out on those who they perceive are below them on the ladder, so to speak. So in the United States, we see this anti-immigrant backlash, and we see the same thing happening throughout Germany and a lot of other European Union countries. So one wonders how long the world can keep creeping along with this Washington Wall Street consensus that doesn't seem to work for most people anymore.
Well, Timothy Canover, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Canover, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University College of Law. He teaches international trade and development law and regulation of international financial institutions, and in 2011, Timothy Canova was appointed by Senator Bernie Sanders to serve on an advisory committee on Federal Reserve reform. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.